Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Gabrielle Myers, and she is author of Hive Mind, a memoir. Hive Mind recounts Gabrielle's experiences on a small organic farm in California's Sacramento Valley during the growing season of 2006, as she apprenticed with a female farmer who took her life at the end of a season drew to a close. The memoir begins with Gabrielle's first day on the farm right after she left her job at an internationally known farm-to-table restaurant with the intention of taking a long break between cooking full-time and starting graduate school. Hive Mind asks what reasons we give ourselves for our sustenance while considering how this care of self and our community can be maintained regardless of life's challenges and simultaneously compromised through alcohol and drug addiction, romantic loss, and a loved one's death. Gabrielle is an associate professor of English, writer, and chef living in the Sacramento Valley of California. For more than a decade, she has worked as a cook and chef for San Francisco Bay Area restaurants and catering companies. Gabrielle is an associate professor of English at San Joaquin Delta College and went to graduate school in her early 30s to earn an MA in English from the University of California at Davis and an FMA in creative writing from St. Mary's College of California. You can find out more by visiting Gabrielle's website, which is GabrielleMyers.com, and that's GabrielleMyers.com. And I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Gabrielle to the show. Good day, Gabrielle.
Hi, good day, Robert. Thank you for having me on.
It is my pleasure, and later on in the show, we're going to talk about some of those wonderful recipes that you have on your website. I am very hungry. I would love to have been a customer in one of those restaurants where you were a chef and cook. This story, I mean, you know, it's a memoir, and so, you know, I'm kind of in a way surprised. I mean, you're a very young woman, and, you know, quite often memoirs come later in life, but it seems that you've really experienced a lot so far. And so what was it that encouraged you to write this particular book?
In many ways, I felt like I had to get the story out there. I felt haunted to tell it, to be honest with you. And there's a part that kept kind of driving me to communicate what mm-hmm. happened to others. And I tried to tell it in one way, through poetry, for about 2 or 3 years, and it didn't work as a way to kind of communicate what I needed to communicate. And I kept coming back to it and coming back to it. In some ways, I was obsessed with it until I actually got it out in the form of a memoir. And so I was, I guess, compelled to finish it.
Yeah. Well, the story, the messages in the book, and you know, how you navigated life so far, and, you know, and the challenges and experiences, you know, are very, very, very important. So I could see why it was really important for you to get that out now. And it's one of those things, you know, like the sooner it got out, the sooner you could help people who are going through similar situations.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I hope it's helpful for others. You know, everyone has somebody in their life probably that they've lost to suicide, either somebody that's close to them or somebody that maybe they wish they were closer to.
Yeah.
And so I think the message in there is something that most of us can relate to.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's helpful.
Yeah, I have no doubt it will be. I mean, you know, that it is. So when you develop this book, and I know, you know, as a writer, it when it comes time to putting the book together, some of the basic format and those kinds of things you have to consider and kind of go back and forth. And in your book, you know, you have it in the form of short entries and organized by month and year. So why did you choose that particular format?
The format of organizing it by month and year merged out of, originally I had kept a journal entry of my time on the farm. And at that point in my life, I kept a journal probably for the 10 years prior to it and kind of a few years after the farm. And so kind of the base of the book, I culled from journal entries of my time there. And then, of course, built around it and had to construct a lot from memory. But that form seemed to lend itself well to telling the story. And I think the timing is really important, the concept of time, but also the timing of in which everything occurred was important. I think the journal entries reflect that. Short entries is I feel like they capture kind of a moment in time, almost like a snapshot of each kind of point along in the time order. And it allowed me to really focus in detail on those moments. Also within kind of the memoir is poetry as well. And that's how I originally tried to communicate the story to others, was through poetry, as I mentioned earlier. And so after I drafted the prose part of the manuscript, I went back and kind of inserted the poetry along the way to reflect back, I think, on the sections of prose and to kind of complement them and to communicate. I think poetry kind of communicates a rupture or a fracture from reality. And I try to insert it kind of at points where there was kind of a break, I think, in the normal fabric of things.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's that English teacher professor coming out here, you know, so I'm going to try to be on my P's and Q's here. You know, first of all, you
don't
know,
worry about it. I'm a human. I make errors all the time.
I don't have anything to be graded by Professor Myers. One of the things, you know, and, you know, you talked about the journal, you know, and you know, for the listeners out there, you know, I really hope that they kind of, you know, take that to heart. One of the things that that has happened before, I've had people who, you know, have been on the show and want to write and don't know what to write. And there was one woman I remember very distinctly called in and was talking to an intuitive guest I had and said that, you know, she wanted to write, didn't know what to write. And so the guest said, well, you know, I have a feeling that you're writing, you're doing something. And she was journaling. I mean, you know, very much like that. And she says, well, you know, you're doing that. You're writing and you know, tell your story. And she was like flabbergasted. Oh, my God, I can't tell my story, you know. And to me, it was like, you know, and my comment to her is like, if you want to write something unique, write your own story. You know what I mean? Because everyone's is unique. But, you know.
That's what you own, right? Nobody has
really.
The experience as you have it. So.
Exactly. And, you know, but also there comes a, for some people, they would look at it as being risky in a way, you know, to put themselves out there in such a direct fashion, to even have it, you know, chronological in a way, you know, as far as years and experiences, that kind of thing. I mean, that brings it home that this is my story. So for you, did you have any kind of reservations about, you know, putting your story out there in you know, such a direct manner?
Yes, I did. I had reservations about telling kind of the parts of my story that, I guess, where I had lost my way and was living kind of life in a manner that wasn't productive. You know, I was compromising my own health, but I was also, I don't think, really responsible to anybody. And it, you know, there's a risk in kind of how other people will perceive that and the assumptions that they're going to make about you as an individual when you present that information to them. So I had reservations about that. I also had reservations about detailing kind of my mom's story. But so much of her story is tied up with mine. And I feel like if you tell a story with love, you can't really go wrong. Even if you admit that, you know, other people aren't perfect and you aren't perfect, I think if you approach it with love and understanding, that it's hard to miss the mark with that. And I also had reservations about telling what happened on the farm, since it was a tragic event that, you know, it didn't just involve me. It involved the other people that were on the farm. People, you know, one person I'm still really close to and love dearly. There are other kind of, I guess that was the hardest thing for me is to present that, because we all have our own versions of the truth. And we tell it to the best of our ability, but everything is always colored through kind of the eyes that we have, filtered through us, right? And so we can both look at the same situation, and it's the same situation, but we're all going to view it slightly differently. And the memoir, you know, you can't avoid owning that, putting it out there. So I had reservations, I guess, all the way around. But in the end, I felt the move to tell the story and was more important than kind of any apprehensions that I had. Or any fears that I had that I would be misunderstood or judged. So the story itself had to get there.
Yeah, you know, and I think you kind of said it in the very top, you know, that if you tell it with love and you do it with, you know, without judgment and just kind of put it out there, you know, we all have times where our, you know, we kind of falter and kind of go astray and you know, it's one of those things where, you know, we may recognize it, putting it out there for someone else to read it is kind of a different thing. But, you know, I think it, for people who read the story, you know, there will be those who will be able to identify that. They may not have had the same, you know, off-path experience, but they will have had an experience, you know, that kind of, you know, that led them astray in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we're all kind of, we've all had our moments, right, of where we've moved maybe in a different direction than what we had intended originally. So.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, and some of us are doing it right now. No.
Exactly. But, we might not know it for 5 more years.
Exactly. You know, and then we're going to talk a little bit, you know, mentioned your mother. We're going to talk a little bit about that, her connection to your story, too. But also, you know, and the farm. I mean, you know, those are you know, so very distinct avenues in a way, as far as, you know, how your story touches other people. And I think for, you know, one of the beauties of the story is to recognize that our story is not alone, you know, in the sense that, you know, our lives touch so many others, you know what I mean? And it's, you know, our experiences touch so many others, and it's just really important to recognize how connected we are, you know, in being able to navigate life.
Yes, we are. We are, and in a sense, that connection is what can pull us through when we can't see the future in front of us. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about the food, the restaurant. And so you, for a while, you worked as a chef in restaurants. I think there was one way it was described as. What was the description? Kind of high activity. I mean, it was like a mill in a way, as far as production.
Very busy farm to table restaurant.
Yeah.
Fine dining, farm to table, but we were busy, very busy. packed on the weekends and pretty busy during the weekday as well. So,
yeah. So for people who don't know farm to table, exactly, I mean, what does that involve?
Usually at farm to table, most of the ingredients that you get directly from the farmer. So either you go to farmer's market and you kind of pick up the ingredients, or the farmer comes to you, and that deals with things from onions, garlic, peppers, tomatoes, right through the meat that you get, like whole hogs, whole lamb, whole fish that come into the restaurant.
Okay.
But you're cooking with the ingredients from usually multiple suppliers, less from, say, a produce company. So restaurants that aren't farm to table tend to rely on produce companies and meat companies to supply the raw product that they work with. And so it's kind of a more direct connection to the farm. Some farm to table restaurants are actually on the farm, which is quite exciting. I never had an experience working in a place like that, or at least not yet.
Okay. Well, you know, so you were in that environment, and then you decided to work on the farm. You know, in particular, the Tip Top Produce was the one that you worked at. So tell us a little bit about why the shift and how that all came about.
I had made the decision about a year and a half before I left working in restaurants to move in a different direction with my life. I wanted to work on my writing, and I didn't necessarily enjoy the pace of restaurant work. There are a lot of things I loved about restaurant work. I loved working as part of a team towards an end goal. I loved kind of the excitement around the daily activities. I actually liked the sense of urgency. But the pace itself and, you know, what I walked away from at the end of the night, kind of looking for something more with what I, how I spent my day. So I decided to go basically back to school to work on my writing. And I wasn't really sure of the next step. It was before I started teaching and really kind of fell in love with that as a daily kind of practice and activity. And I had always loved growing things, and that's kind of how I fell into cooking. Was I would work in plant nurseries, and I did an internship at Monticello and would work up in their vegetable gardens, and we'd get to take vegetables and herbs home, and then I would cook with them. Mm. And that is like the process that led me to fall in love with cooking. And so when I was kind of at a turning point in my life trying to figure out what to do, I came back to that, and I find kind of immense joy and satisfaction and connection with something else, I guess, like a larger, I don't know, guiding kind of force in the world when I garden, when I'm outside in nature. And so I decided to go back to that, and that's what led me to decide to go work on a farm. And then Laura Trent, who was the farmer and the owner of Tip Top Produce, was actually a supplier at Olivetto. And so I talked to the head chef, the executive chef, and asked him for some guidance as to, you know, what would be the best farm to go working to go work at. And he suggested I go to Tip Top Produce. So I contacted Laura and started volunteering there in the early spring before officially kind of moving out there and living and working on the farm at the beginning of April of that year. So that was the path that led me.
Wow, yeah, you know, and now, I mean, well, how was working on her farm, as far as how was her farm different from, you know, from other farms?
She is what we call a rock star farmer. she had just this knack of picking kind of unusual varieties to grow, but varieties that all the top restaurants and all the foodies wanted. And she didn't have that much acreage. She only had 22 acres and a significant, I think only about 9 or 10 acres of the farm was in cultivation outside of Italian prune plums. So most of the farm was Italian prune plum kind of cultivation, but then we only had a few acres of these heirloom vegetables that you would grow. She would grow them organically and she had a green thumb in terms of knowing exactly kind of what the plants needed to thrive. And she also picked things right at the point of ripeness. And so what some farmers do is they pick things before they're ripe. So they travel well in market, and they kind of travel well to the restaurants. And she kind of went against that and thought that if you pick things early, you actually don't get the full flavor. And you have to wait until they're ripe, pick them that morning, and then sell them that afternoon. And so there was that kind of intensity about the work that she would do. Sure, it would be more convenient for her to harvest things a day or two before trying to sell them, but that wasn't the way she rolled. So she would pick them, you know, early in the morning, and then, you know, we'd get up at 5 o'clock or 5:30 in the morning, harvest things, and then take them directly to the market to sell. And the customers knew the difference, and the chefs that we sold to knew the difference, because you can't get better produce than that really anywhere in the world.
Yeah, that's, you know, the I can understand why, you know, that you know, picking them and doing the shipping right at the peak, you know, that it would, I mean, that would be like the maximum freshness, but it also, yeah, I could see where it's like, you know, the intensity of making sure that it got to, you know, its end destination, you know, still, you know, you know, fresh and that kind of thing. So, I mean, I can see where that kind of would have put a little bit of a pressure on distribution, you know, where, you know, but I'm sure that, you know, chefs like that. So was her market, like, just right there up in the valley and maybe in San Francisco as far as customers?
Yes, mostly it was in the East Bay of San Francisco, but some chefs would travel from San Francisco to get the produce that she would sell at the farmers markets in Berkeley and in Oakland. For example, Boulette's Larder, which was a place I ended up actually working, cooking at that restaurant for a while. They'd come out from the Ferry Plaza building in San Francisco to the Berkeley farmers market on Tuesday to get the produce that Laura would bring in. So mostly her market was the Bay Area, and she did quite well there. She built a name for herself there. And there are other people that are really involved in food, especially back then. I think now things have changed, and now in Sacramento, definitely people are very interested in buying things from local sources, and they're interested in their own vegetables. But back then, the Bay Area was really kind of the place where people were willing to pay, you know, what they should for the best quality produce. So.
Yeah. I mean, because doing it organically and green, you know, takes extra time and extra care, and there's, you know, associated costs with that, I'm sure.
Yes, definitely. I mean, just weeding, you know, you don't go out there and spray the crops with Roundup by plane or by hand. You have to go out, you pull the weeds as necessary. And that can be very labor intensive. I remember we spent, gosh, it must have been like 2 or 3 days. Getting the weeds out of the row that we had planted torpedo onions in. And the torpedo onions were pretty young. And so if we didn't get the weeds out, then the weeds would basically take over the whole row, and the torpedo onions wouldn't be able to grow. And so we had to be very careful as well as we were pulling the weeds out, or we might pull out the torpedo onion. And so it just takes a lot of time. And I don't think people kind of fully understand that until they've been to a farm or until they've tried to garden themselves organically. But it would be a lot easier to spray with Roundup. But in the end, you know, there are health impacts and environmental impacts with approaches like that.
Yeah, that Roundup is nasty stuff, for sure.
Yeah.
But luckily, California has kind of wised up to, you know, the toxicity of that. But, one of the things that, you know, plays a part in the book is Farmer Laura's death. So, can you talk a little bit about that? Because, you know, that, you know, in the beginning you talked a little bit about suicide, and so let's talk about kind of what, you know, the circumstances were around that.
Well, she was obviously depressed, and kind of, I guess I didn't realize how depressed she was until she did try to take her life. but she had an ongoing kind of struggle with depression, and some information came out after she committed that act regarding the fact that she might have been manic depressive. And there's the idea that perhaps she was in a manic phase and then crashed, and kind of that presented itself in the suicide. But she was struggling, and apparently she had gone off her medication as well, that she was on Paxil and had gone off that, and also was taking Zyban, which she had ordered online to try to help her quit smoking. And so there was the idea that there was kind of this cocktail that she was taking. She was also on sinus medication at the time. So that, combined with the depression, combined with a breakup, I think led her kind of to make that decision. It's complicated because in many ways, I think, looking back at it, she, I think, thought her mom committed suicide. And I think in some ways she kind of romanticized that decision, which I guess that for me was always hard to understand. Or it's still
is. Yeah.
But there's that all or nothing kind of, I guess.
Yeah. So now, when you were there and working with her, were you kind of, did you have any awareness of the, you know, of the depression or the mood shift, you know, that kind of thing? Or, I mean, it was just completely out of the blue for you?
Well, I noticed that she was kind of, her mood would shift often. And, you know, just meeting someone in April and knowing them until, like, the end of the end of September is, then her personality would shift, but I didn't really know why or what was the cause. You know, I just assumed it was something that was happening, something that the other intern did or that I did or, you know, that her friend did, as opposed to it being something that was kind of chemically based. And so I knew that her, you know, she had shifts, and I knew that we talked about depression, and we talked about kind of addiction to substances as a way, you know, that we in the past had dealt with depression. I had a history with depression when I was in my 20s. You know, I had kind of a moment when, or several years in which I was depressed, and how I coped with it was, you know, through alcohol abuse and through marijuana abuse, to be honest with you. And she had a similar kind of way of dealing with things. And so we talked about that, and we had open conversations, you know, about kind of different decisions that would yield better results. And I talked with her about my mom and kind of my mom's story, how she found her way out of kind of the darkness of depression and addiction. And so we had conversations about that. You know, she never directly said, "I'm going to kill myself" or anything like that. And looking back, you know, I can look at certain things she said, or allusions, I guess, that she made, or actions that she took, and put it in the context of her final decision. But at the time, I didn't know how to read them. I don't know if that makes sense, but they're like kind of the signs that now looking back, I'm like, oh, maybe that's what she meant when she said that. And the connection kind of making is a lot clearer now than it was at the time when I was first hearing some of the things that she said, or first looking and kind of observing her behavior.
Well, yeah, you know, I think that hindsight, you know, is common, you know, when, you know, someone around them, you know, commit suicide, you know, because it's, you know, quite often it's the, you know, is there something that I missed? You know, is there something I could have done? Is, you know, I mean, there's a whole lot of questioning, because for most people, you know, the idea, like you said, you know, you couldn't really understand, you know, like the romanticizing in a way, or the that particular aspect of suicide, you know, for most people, I think, you know, we find it difficult to understand someone making that choice, you know, versus working through, you know. And so I think it's just a real common practice for human nature in a way to be able to, I mean, to go back and question, you know, why. And but, you know, I think the, you know, the real important thing is that, you know, that we, when that particular situation happens, is to, you know, from what I've seen and just from the people I know who have, you know, been around it, and I've had that happen to people I've known as well, is whenever that happens, it seems that the immediate response for many people is just the instant recognition of how valuable life is. And how important it is to live every, you know, every day, you know, to its fullest. Did you have that kind of reaction afterwards? I know for me, it's one of those things that every time that I think about that, I mean, it started probably about 30 years ago when I had a cousin who committed suicide, and, you know, and then it was just one of those things where it's like, you know, from that point on, it's like, you know, things can be rough, but, you know, we don't necessarily have to go to that distance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's same thing happened to me after my mom's attempt, and she recovered, thankfully, and is very healthy now, and after Laura's attempt, is this kind of movement towards life, and rather than look for reasons to end life, I look for reasons to kind of embrace it and to be thankful that I, little things matter so much. The smell of an orange tree in bloom, the feel of a tomato skin when it was ripe and just about to burst. Little things like that actually mattered significantly to me. And this kind of awareness of, I don't know, how lucky we are to just have each moment that we have before us, even if it's kind of shitty and we're going through a hard time, at least like we have that. And we, you know, we can still, you know, take a deep breath and you know, feel the sun on our skin if we choose to.
Right.
Or at least the wind and rain on our skin if it's in the middle of winter. but to have that choice, I guess.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Mattered
more
than anything.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we're going to take a real quick break here, and I do want to invite anyone listening, if you would like to call in and ask Gabrielle any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those of you listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions that you would like for me to pose to Gabrielle, feel free to type them in, and we'll get to them after the break. And then right after the break, Gabrielle, I kind of wanted to find out from you, you know, what did you learn about, you know, the life of a modern day farmer, you know, and some of the you know, the joys and the challenges that profession now has. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Okay, great. Everyone, stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break. Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there, or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc., and we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, also on the site is a link to the great products we provide. Books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show. Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my very special guest is Gabrielle Myers, and we're talking about her book, Hive Mind, a memoir. And again, you can find out more about Gabrielle's book. Also, wonderful resources on her website, recipes, videos, all kinds of stuff. Her website, again, is www.gabriellemyers.com, and that's GABRIELLEMYRES.com. And again, I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back. Gabrielle?
Hi, Robert.
Hey there. Great. Okay.
Glad to
well,
be back.
So, thank you. I appreciate that. So, life on a modern day farm. What was it? Everything you expected, or were there some surprises that you had when you went to work there?
There were some surprises. In some ways, I had this kind of vision of working on a farm, especially a small organic farm. But that reality actually lived up to, which was exciting. It was when I was at the farm, it was just as exciting as I had imagined, kind of pulling the garlic out of the earth and smelling the soil on my fingers and feeling the sun beating down on my face. Even when it was 105 degrees, it was still kind of the sensual aspects of working on the farm I loved. And the sounds of the crickets and the sounds of the frogs coming in during the spring and falling into the crickets in the summer, all that I loved. It was really hard work, which I, knew, I guess, but I didn't, I knew it in my brain and my body before I went to work on the farm. Uh-huh. Farmers work so hard, especially organic farmers, where most of what you're doing, sure, you have a tractor and, you have kind of tools, but a lot of it is by hand, the work that you do. So it was a good workout every day. We'd get up early, as the sun rose, and we'd be out there. And we'd take a break for lunch, but generally we'd be working all day, often, until sunset. So it was very labor-intensive, the work, which, is part of what I really loved about it. I would say it's hard to be a farmer. Any kind of farmer, period, whether you're conventional or you're organic, you have 1,000 acres or you have 22 acres, as in the case of the farmer, you're going to work probably harder than you ever have in your life at any other job. You don't work quite as hard, I think, not just physically but mentally, trying to figure out how to make it work. It's interesting, even for, I think, organic produce, we don't really pay, I think, that much for it, for the amount of work that's put in. When you really think about, how much, work is put into clearing the weeds around the garlic or to picking, all the cherry tomatoes that go into a pint, and making sure that those cherry tomatoes are irrigated, making sure that they're fertilized properly, and that they make it, from the seedling stage. All that, it takes a lot of work for kind of like the end result of what we see at the market in terms of prices. It seems like a lot, because most of us are stretched and everything kind of feels expensive, but it's a lot of work that goes into that. It's also a lot of work for them to think about kind of how to make ends meet and come up with kind of ways to be sustainable financially. And so farmer was always trying to kind of think of what product, what heirloom vegetable she could grow, or what type of a fruit she could grow that would allow her to be sustainable. So what would sell and what would sell for a decent price to make ends meet for her financially. So
yeah. Yeah,
I think that's kind of like the hardest part about being a farmer is like, so what is a winning combination to make it sustainable?
Yeah.
And that combination has to change and shift with the market as that changes and shifts, and you have to kind of anticipate what people will want before they actually want it. And before other farmers start growing it, and kind of like, then your price has to lower in response to their low prices. So.
Yeah, you know, that is one of the strange things. You know, gosh, when I was just a wee lad, one of my I actually worked on a farm for like one summer. I mean, I was probably early teens, I think. And it was a friend of a family's farm, and it was a dairy farm. But it was the hardest I had worked in my entire life. And I knew right then, at that summer, I was going to work my damnedest in school to make sure I didn't have to work on the farm, you know. But it was.
Just the dairy farm with the heavy buckets.
Yes, yes. And then bales of hay. I mean, you know, I just, my hands were raw from you know, baling hay and lifting bales of hay. But there was a, like you talked about, you know, the crickets, the nature aspect. There was just something about it, and I really think that really kind of instilled in me, you know, my current love of nature. You know, the fact that, you know, I just love being around it and in it and appreciate nature to its fullest. And I think that's one of the things, you know, the farmer and the land, you know, that connection is it's just a wonderful connection that you really can't get with any other profession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Brought up right close to it, right, in full contact with it, and kind of all its complexity. Like, nature isn't kind of like this place of it's not always a sanctuary where we can retreat. Like, in some ways, kind of like there's a challenge in kind of when you're a farmer of being present in nature as it is and accepting it the way it is, with kind of sometimes you're going to lose your whole crop, and sometimes it's going to rain too much and you can't get your crops in the field, and sometimes you're going to be in a drought, and that's going to be, you know, make it really difficult for you to make a living. You can't escape from nature there. And so there's this, in some ways, a full embrace of it when you're a farmer, I think, in all of its kind of complexity, and not just kind of like this romantic notion of nature.
Yeah, I agree. Now, did you, in this particular process, did you learn something about yourself that maybe you didn't know prior to working on the farm?
I did. I think I learned a lot about myself, and I think it changed kind of who I was. I think that it made me appreciate food more, and just kind of how it's kind of an amazing thing to see something grow and then become complete in the form of a tomato that I can then eat, and to see that happening 1,000 times throughout the course of the growing season, you know, with garlic, with the tomatoes, with okra, with the prune plums, with the figs. To see that happen again and again, there's this deep appreciation for that process, and respect for kind of the final end product that we get from that. I think that it made me realize how important it is to embrace life. And that kind of, you know, emerged out of what happened with Farmer, and how we have to kind of care for ourselves and not just love ourselves, but make good decisions that will enable us to thrive. And that in the end, like, we're the ones that we have to do that for ourselves. Nobody else can do that for us. And so I guess a sense of responsibility to care for the self, and to realize that sometimes, like, what we think is just impacting us in kind of in our head and That impacts others a lot, and we have to kind of be aware of that, but also live our life in reference to other people, and kind of know that what we put out there can form them, and be careful, I guess, with what we do, kind of allow ourselves to be.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, it's one of those things where you really get an appreciation of, like I said, I think earlier in the show, the interconnectedness of everything and everyone. You know what I mean? And it's just in recognizing that, you know, you can, just by your own actions and supporting others, you know, that you can really turn things around for some people, you know, and actually for yourself as well in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now,
with working on the farm, you know, you talked about you're kind of getting back to the ingredients, so to speak, you know, so after working on the farm, has that influenced your cooking from when you were in the, you know, the constant restaurant environment to the farm? Did it shift your perspective at all on cooking or how you cook?
I'd say it did. In many ways, it cemented the philosophy that I learned when I was at Olivetto. And that table, that farm to table restaurant that I mentioned earlier, there, kind of the way that we treated food was we didn't try to manipulate it. The approach was more like chef is meant to bring out the flavors in the ingredients that they work with. So how can we make the tomato appear on that plate in its kind of its true self? And how can we do that with the halibut fillet that we're cooking, and how can we do that with the crab that we're picking and putting into a crab cake? And so that came kind of like from that school, which is really different from, you know, a lot of, I guess, chefs that approach cooking with, they're still working with the ingredients and trying to remain kind of true to them, but there's a sense of manipulating the product and kind of jumping through a lot of hoops in kind of how they're presenting it. And that's not the kind of the school I came from. And so working on the farm really made me, I guess, appreciate and get deeper into that practice with cooking. And I think that in some ways it simplified my approach to food. And so rather than putting, say, on a plate 5 or 6 different ingredients, there's a move to just have 3 and make the 3 that are on that plate really shine through and give the best kind of representation of each ingredient. So there's, like, the tomato. There's a ripe tomato, and then there's a ripe tomato that has that perfect balance of sweet and sweetness and acidity. And then kind of that round flavor that each variety of tomato brings. And so I guess it was more selective in when I was picking something that was ripe to make sure that it was at the peak of ripeness, not just generally ripe, if that makes sense.
And to
realize that if the ingredient's not kind of at that perfect level of ripeness, you shouldn't just not use it, and you should wait until it gets there.
Yeah, good. One of the things, like I mentioned a couple of times about your recipes online on your website, you know, I noticed, you know, there were a couple in particular that simplicity was kind of a key to the recipe, and I thought, this is my kind of recipe, simple and, you know, easy to use and quick to do. So now. One of the things, you know, we mentioned earlier in the interview about your book details toward the end of the book about your mother's recovery from alcoholism and her own attempted suicide. So, first of all, how is she doing? Is she healthy?
She's very healthy. You know, it's odd. We were together over the Christmas break, and I looked at her one time. And I thought, you know what, she looks better than she did 30 years ago. I don't know if that's possible. But it's almost like she's reversed the aging process. She's doing wonderful. She's been sober now, gosh, what is it, over 12 years. And she just got a chip from AA for that. And she's very involved in AA as a treasurer, but also as a sponsor for other people that are kind of going through that process of the 12 steps. She's taken to farming herself, and so she lives in Virginia with my dad, and she's gotten into raising grass-fed beef, chickens for the meat, but also for the eggs. For a while, she had goats, but decided that wasn't the best combination for the farm, because the goats would jump in her car and then jump out the back and burst through a window. and they kept escaping, trying to get in the house. So the goats had to go, but she's with the grass-fed beef and the chickens. And so that activity, I think, has really been wonderful for her. And she goes to the farmer's markets in the town where she lives and sells things, also to small grocery stores. And so she's kind of, in many ways, I think, I just so admire kind of her strengths in coming from a point where things were pretty low. They probably couldn't get more power, to really taking a close look at herself and kind of thinking about how to live in a manner that's kinder to herself, and she's really turned things around. And we have a good time together. We went skiing, or cross country skiing, as a family over the break, and so that was a lot of fun that we were able to do that. We were able to spend time with my niece and nephew, and I would think of it like as a gift.
Yes. Yeah.
Things were looking pretty bad there for a while, and she was in the ER and in a coma for 72 hours, the doctor said we might have to pull the plug on her. Now to think about, how over just the course of 12 years, things have changed dramatically is amazing to me.
Well, and I think the beauty in that is if you ever encounter anyone who is where she was, being able to relate the story of her progress and her success, and I'm sure, and we didn't come without challenges, but nonetheless, there is a something to look forward to, that in itself can be inspirational, So when when you decided to include her in your story, obviously she's, kind of like working the program and working her life. So was she kind of open to the fact that you were going to make her or include her in your particular memoir?
Yeah, she was aware of it. And I shared kind of the memoir with her as I was working on it. Once, I realized that she had to be included. There was no way of avoiding it. And she read it kind of as I was developing it. And then also when it was kind of relatively as complete as any book can be, she read it again. She's been very supportive. And I think she understands why I needed to include her. And I think that in many ways it strengthened our relationship, because there's kind of being open and honest, right, about kind of the experience and how it impacted me, but also, being honest about my respect for her and kind of my, my admiration for what she's done, really, with her life.
That's great. Yeah, and that's wonderful. And well, gosh, we're already down to toward the end of the show, Gabrielle. So this has really been enjoyable. So, and I mentioned that you have on your website, I mentioned a few times about your recipes. I'm not necessarily a foodie, but I really liked looking at that. So, can you talk a little bit about you have a blog that's devoted to gluten and dairy free recipes. Is that something that you've noticed as being very important in some of today's environment?
It is. I think that there are a lot of us now that we, realize that we're allergic to certain foods, and so it's important that there are alternatives out there for us in terms of recipes. And honestly, it's pretty easy, I think. When I think of my approach to gluten and dairy-free lifestyle. I don't try to create something that replaces cheese in a recipe or something that kind of acts like wheat acts in a recipe. I try to really build a cuisine that doesn't need those types of ingredients. And so I feel like it's a different take on that type of diet. And I think it's also a diet that is kind of natural and healthy for us. I also try to forward recipes where people can get things or they are encouraged to get things from responsible purveyors, and so responsible producers in terms of meat that has been kind of given humane care and set out to pasture, but also getting vegetables that are in season and that are fresh kind of at that point in time. And so I try to have seasonal recipes as well, really as the base for each blog post. So now I just recently posted a grilled spring vegetable recipe with an avocado and orange sauce.
Yes, I saw that.
So this time of year, you will not find tomatoes on the blog, and you will not find figs because we can't get those here.
Okay.
We'd have to import them from, you know, the other side of the world. So
okay.
That's the approach that I try to adopt for each blog post. And each blog post features a recipe, a seasonal recipe.
Well, that's great. Yeah, that's you know, having it seasonal is perfect, because I know so many of my friends who love to, you know, take advantage of whatever type of vegetable is, you know, is in season, and you know, I live in South Carolina, and you know, we have roadside produce stands everywhere, you know, from the farms, and so I mean, it's just one of those things where we really like to take advantage of that. So, well, gosh, and I guess maybe one last thing. If, you know, what do you hope that, you know, someone reading Hive Mind will walk away with? What do you hope that your book achieves for the reader?
I think an appreciation of life, and I think a willingness to embrace it in all its complexity. But that's kind of what I want the takeaway to be. I hope
that just sums it up. And that's an excellent, you know, from what I've read in talking to you, and also seeing the wonderful information that you contain, you know, that is, I can see that would be achieved. So that's, you know, that's certainly something that basically you're just helping people live a better life, and that's admirable, and it's wonderful for you to be able to put your story out there right in front of everybody. You know, the good, the challenging, and you know, the successes. So I want to thank you for your time today. I really appreciate talking to you.
Thank you. I had a lovely time talking with you, Robert. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Gabrielle Myers. We've been talking about her memoir, Hive Mind. And again, you can find out more about her book and all of the wonderful recipes. She's got videos, all kinds of things available on her website, which is www.gabriellemyers.com. And again, I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Bite Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.